go ahead and start as a subcommittee of the subcommittee. This morning we are continuing the public hearing possible work session on House Bill 5053, the Oregon Department of Transportation. This morning we have a presentation on non-limited capital improvements. Linda Gilbert, Grace Klenikin, and Mike Marsh, please come forward. Okay. Welcome back.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Linda will start off.
Mr. Chair, member of the committee, beginning with non-limited, the governor's revised budget is $67.6 million. It is a 34% reduction from the $97.99 legislatively approved budget. The reasons for that are reduced debt service of $21.6 million. This is a debt service that was associated with the $200 million of bonds that have been eliminated from the highway section of the budget. There's a reduced limitation for fleet management. There is a shift of the materials lab from non-limited to highway, and a shift of the Oregon Transportation Infrastructure Lending Fund into non-limited. Moving to the second page of the handout, there are three policy packages. You have heard about all of these before in the respective highway limitation, but we'll go over them again. These are the policy packages that are companions to the ones that are in highway. First, in budget realignment, this package moves the entire Reaper Graphics unit and 11 positions from central services into non-limited. Reaper Graphics operates in a manner consistent with non-limited activity. The package also shifts two employees from non-limited back into central services. The agency has reduced inventory in the storeroom, and these positions make purchases for the entire department, not just for the storeroom. The total cost is $1.2 million, other funds in nine positions.
Can I ask you there, Linda, other funds in nine positions up above, you indicate the positions as being 11 positions. Are we deleting a couple positions?
Mr. Chair, that's correct. There are 11 positions that are moving from central services to non-limited, and then there are two positions that are moving from non-limited to central services. So there's a net.
So if we approve this move, and as you indicate here, operating expenditures with fluctuating revenues, and the revenues, for whatever reason, might go down, what does that do to the transfer of the positions?
The positions are still there.
But they may not be funded.
Correct. That's correct.
Is that a better position to have rather than having them central services where you know it's a fixed cost?
Mr. Chair, Mike Morris from ODOT. The whole non-limited area has this same problem because we're a demand-driven function in the non-limited area. So what that means is that, as the Chair knows, if the business isn't there, the position being filled will not occur. And therefore, any expenditure limitation that's shown here, if the business doesn't come to us, then we won't have the expenditure.
Let me try to rephrase it then, Mike. Do these positions exist, or are they new and anticipated new positions?
Sure, they exist, and we're shifting them from, in some cases in this budget, some of them are going from non-limited to the limited budget, and some are going in reverse. The only reason they're shifting is to make sure that we're consistent on our accounting definitions of what should be in non-limited and what should not.
And what I heard you just say is if the workload is not there, then the positions would be limited.
Correct.
Or eliminated.
Correct.
Okay. All right.
Package number 142 is the Oregon Transportation Infrastructure Fund lending funds into non-limited, and this is to make those funds consistent with the way other agencies budget similar funds. This is $10.2 million, other funds from highway to non-limited. Finally, package 148, materials lab to highway. This is a package that shifts from non-limited to highway because of the change in the nature of the work the materials lab is doing. revenues from outside agencies have dropped to an insignificant level, and this negates any reason to, that the budget should be in the non-limited area. So this is negative $6.6 million, other funds, and 47 positions.
Now, getting back to this, Linda, budget 140 item and then 148, now you're transferring in and out positions because of insignificant level of revenues from outside agencies. What bothers me and is continuing to bother me over the time that I've been here is one budget cycle we budget everybody in, and the next budget cycle we come back and find out we can't sustain it, so we budget them back. Is this a permanent solution, or is this again a two-year fix?
Mr. Chair, this is intended to be longer than a two-year fix. This, in Package 148, there's a recognition of the of a gradual change in the nature of the work that the materials lab has been doing. And because more of it is internally generated, less of it is externally generated, it made sense to pull us out of the non-limited functions, less market-driven.
If the revenues from outside agencies who are requesting the service is declining, is any look or consideration given to deleting some of the 47 positions?
Mr. Chair, we did not look at that on the assumption that there is still the work to do. It's just become more an internal to the agency type of work.
And Mr. Chair, to follow up, if the market of and business does not come to us, next time we'd make an adjustment that says the market's going elsewhere, we can't compete with the private sector, we'll recognize that and reduce the positions or whatever the situation is. Or the reverse could occur. If the business increases and we feel like we're providing a product that more individuals and the local governments want and more other state agencies, then we may come back to seek additional positions. But it will be according to the situation from the private sector business.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Grace Cunningham, if I could add to that, we're shifting generally in the business at ODOT of having the contractors do more of the quality assurance side of things, and we come in and audit periodically things as opposed to all the materials being tested at ODOT. So there has been a substantial shift, not just in ODOT, but in states, other states as well. And so I think there may be some room in the future if the business does change, we'd go there. But this really reflects a whole change in the way we do quality assurance, quality control work, and the materials lab used to do everything for everybody. And their work has shifted. And I do think you're right. If we end up in a situation where we contract some of that stuff out, we may shift, but that will come down the road, so to speak, from now, as we determine what is it's going to take to sustain that. I'm also quite leery as a director of giving up our abilities to do that quality assurance, because we're not sure how this work with industry is going to go with them doing it themselves. So if we start finding shoddy work, we may have to go in and take more control over that. That's the solution. Now, there may be another solution that's out there. So I would hope in the short term that we're able to maintain our talent and skills in this area so that we're able to monitor the work that is being done and reserve the right to come back and build that program back up. But Mike's right, we could shift the other way just as easily.
Thank you. Are there any questions by committee members? If not, if you want to continue, please.
The technical adjustments to the governor's revised budget include reducing fleet management limitation by $16 million to better reflect actual activity, reducing debt service on revenue bonding, as I discussed earlier, that's $21.6 million reduction, and shifting fleet management positions from non-limited to central services. And so the total came from 106.2 million in governor's recommended to 67.65 million in governor's revised.
Okay. Are there any questions? If not, thank you, Linda. Mike, do you want to?
Mr. Chair, I'll start off with the daunting task of defining what non-limited is.
Okay.
try to put this into easy context. I think the members have run into this with other budgets, but the bottom line to the non-limited concept is that it defines a purpose but sets no dollar limit. So there's not an expenditure limitation on these areas of the budget. And the reason is, according to the accounting manuals, because costs cannot be avoided, stopped, or reduced by agency action. So the concept is that we're entrepreneurial or driving off the demand from the business that comes forward. In this case, sometimes it's local government, sometimes it's other state agencies, sometimes it's within the Department of Transportation. So this area means that it's approved by the legislature, but not limited in the appropriation bill, not limited by an expenditure limitation. Before I go further, I want to make sure that that concept is making sense. I know with a lot of members it's like, why do we even do this crazy accounting stuff? But I think it makes sense in terms of not having double budgeting. not seeing questions, I'll move on. The non-limited portion of the budget for us at ODOT relates to several programs, and if you have this handout in front of you, it says non-limited. I'll move into that. It includes debt service as well as programs as well as sales to outside agencies. The first area is dealing with debt service and the Oregon Transportation Infrastructure Fund. The OTIF, or Oregon Transportation Infrastructure Fund, is a fund that was established significantly for local governments to have an opportunity to come forward and use financing authority that's in the statute for the state of Oregon to give loans to the local governments to do projects that they don't have the immediate upfront funds to complete, but they can use our state funds to do the projects. These projects include everything from bridge rebuilding to widening of bridges to local vehicle maintenance stations to a broad range of projects that they can use these funds for. We have $12 million in the fund. The second area there listed is in the operations area within the program. Materials laboratory, briefly mentioned. This has been our testing lab for testing materials from paint to see how long paint will last on the roadway and which kinds will last the best, to asphalt itself, to other mixes of materials. And the fact is we're trying to find the best mix, so to speak, of private sector quality assurance and public sector quality assurance. And so that's why this program is being moved. The traffic signal services function involves the installation and repair and service to local government as well as within ODOT. And then within support services, as part of the central services function, we have fleet operations, which means the purchase of the fuel, the sales, fabrication of things like snowplow devices or attachments. Mainly it's focusing on repair and provision of the service of everything from light vehicles to heavy dump trucks and snow removal equipment. Supply operations relate to items from parts to things that would be such as license plates, titles for DMV, warehousing of forms, and a broad range of storage items that we have, as well as making sure we keep our facilities and fleet in the parts that they need. And reprographic services, I mentioned the other day, I probably won't, I'll need to stop using that term maybe, but what reprographics gets at, as we discussed the other day, are photography, including aerial photography, as well as video production, document processing, the copying of blueprints, copying of other materials, copy center for regular type office copying that occurs. Those are the main programs, and the main customers for those programs are within ODOT, our other state agencies, and our local government. So we have a significant partnership, as a matter of fact, to carry out these programs with local governments. We have 14 interagency agreements to make sure that we're clear about the provision of services that we're allowing for, whether it's fuel purchasing or emergency repairs or parts or whatever it might be, that we have these agreements in place for working with them. Particularly large amounts of contact would be with Department of Administrative Services, Parks, and other state agencies, as well as corrections. As far as service locations, we've got locations in Bend, LeGrand, and Salem for doing our fleet work, as well as 29 field mechanics who move around the state to respond to the needs as they exist.
Mike, can I ask you on your going back momentarily to your definition of non-limited.
I wanted to ask you, when are limited funds considered to be non-limited funds? When they purchase a service?
Mr. Chair, I don't think you would ever have limited funds be considered non-limited funds. The way it would work is that a limited entity like Highway needs to have some work done by a non-limited service provider, like maintenance work. So the vehicle goes in for maintenance, and Highway pays from its budget the dollars to the, in essence, to the mechanic to do the work. So the money coming from the business, so to speak, is just like a business in the private sector paying and for a service, and then that non-limited function pays their employee with non-limited funds. So the budget that's doing the work is shown as limited. The budget that the employee actually provides the labor shows it as non-limited.
Okay. So by changing these positions around like you're asking us to do or consider, we don't get in the potential position charging for a service only to find out it became limited and we designated the person to be unlimited.
Mr. Chair, correct. By saying that it's non-limited, that means we do not have expenditure limitation to pay for that function. If we tried to use limited dollars for it, we would run out of limitation. The legislature is controlling our expenditure limitation. They're not controlling the non-limited area. They're saying go out and do good, and if the business isn't there, that's going to dry up.
Okay. This is very short.
What is the difference between the maintenance portion of the highway department and the fleet operations maintenance fabrication repair?
Excellent question, Mr. Chair and Mr. Trainer. There's been several times when members have gotten confused between maintenance in the Department of Transportation as it relates to maintenance of the highway or maintenance of facilities or maintenance of equipment. The vast majority of maintenance within our budget relates to maintenance of the highway. We're talking about in the last several biennium, it's always been $200 to $300 million. For our facilities, we have a small portion of the budget relating to taking care of our buildings. We have approximately 1,000 different kinds of structures, buildings in the major buildings in the organization. And so there's a lot of facility work that needs to occur there. There's a sizable fleet with maintenance of the fleet. So the work that's done on the highway is a limited portion of the budget. It's the operating element of the Department of Transportation. It's a major line of work that we do. So that's limited and controlled, and you understand, or we hopefully have communicated what that program is about. Maintenance of the facilities and maintenance of the vehicles are a different matter. We've got the vehicle maintenance is in this budget as a non-limited item because the way that's done is that the operating division sends the money in, and it's non-limited in terms of doing the work for that operating division. So it's a different provision of service. It's much smaller than the highway maintenance work, and it doesn't relate to the on-the-road component directly. It's providing that support service. Does that answer your question?
Yes. And we'll be getting into why we have our own shops doing that as opposed to just, you know, calling Joe's, you know, repair down the road.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Schrader, yes, I'd be happy to get into it. I will get into that.
One of the things that would be helpful on that, Mike, is dedicated less to Schrader's question, is do we have to, in essence, make work sometimes because the person that is doing the repair is going to be paid 8 hours a day, 40 hours per week. And so therefore, do we have to make work sometimes to justify that position? Going back to my days in the city of Ashland, when I worked there, it seemed like some of the employees were paid regardless whether they were doing fleet maintenance or whether they were doing cutting weeds in an intersection to helter skelter of any kind of jobs, because they were on an ongoing permanent FTE position and they had to almost make work to justify the permanent funding of those positions. And so I ask you on this, is that possibly occurring, that we have to go out and find other work to generate justification for some of these positions?
Mr. Chair, a couple of responses. First is that that's the benefit of non-limited. If the business isn't there, we don't continue the positions. And it's understood with employees in the non-limited area that if you don't have the business, if we don't market and have the business coming in, the demand isn't there, we can't support the positions.
Okay.
And we do make adjustments over time. As the demand does not fund positions, we make those reductions.
Okay.
Of course, the second point, Mr. Chair, is that that's not been a problem within the estimates that we have at this point. When we do have a slight, as the Chair is implying, workload is not constant. It does go back and forth. We try to hire positions at the lower end of the level, and then if we have additional work that needs to be done that we cannot cover, we do contract those portions out.
Well, it used to be, as an example, people worked for the state forestry for 6 months, and then worked for ODOT for 6 months, and they plowed snow, they sanded roads, they did road maintenance for 6 months, and then for 6 months they were assigned over to forestry and did fire suppression and thinning the forest over a side of work crews. Is some of that activity still going on with shared employees?
Mr. Chair, the highway maintenance function is not within the non-limited area, so I don't deal with the supervision of that. I wouldn't doubt there's still some sharing like that, but my understanding of the majority of employees at ODOT are that they may do snow plowing in the winter, but they'll do brush clearing or ditch work or other work in the summertime so that they have enough work within the ODOT system to take care of most of that. I'll turn around and see if there's any comment from others about that.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Greg Pennington, we do still have some seasonal hires where for the winter we do staff up. Not staff up, but we have temporaries that are there that are really, and they do work for other.
Are those limited or non-limited positions?
Mr. Chairman, those are limited positions.
Oh, they are?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Schrader?
Would it be possible then to get like a look chart that would show for the last two biennium for the different operations, the traffic signal, fleet, and supply, and repo, that, you know, what the budget's been, what the workload's been, and then what the FTE's been? That would give us a pretty good idea.
Mr. Chair, I think we should be able to get that. I'll get back and then see what we have in terms of the long term. I know in most of those cases we have a pretty good tracking of workload. I'll find out.
Maybe if you could provide that to all the committee members, too.
And Mr. Chair, would you separate the sign shop out in that supply operations area?
Okay.
Continuing on, Mr. Chair, looking at the page 2, there's a listing of the organization chart that indicates what portion of the budget is limited and that portion that is not. The shaded areas are those that are under expenditure limitation. The non-shaded or white areas are those that are non-limited. Traffic signal services, supply, repro graphics, fleet management, and the Oregon Transportation Infrastructure Fund, as we mentioned. The three areas with changes that Linda already mentioned briefly are in the supply area, where the two FTE are moving out to the limited budget. The repro graphics area, where we're moving them into the non-limited area because of the demand-driven nature of the photo and copy center and blueprint work. And the Oregon Transportation Infrastructure Fund, which is the revolving loan fund used by local government I mentioned earlier, and we're moving that in to be consistent with other state agencies and the accounting instructions. Mr. Chair, I'll move on to page 3. There are no questions there. that the issues within the area of non-limited have hit on pretty significantly the concept of workload growth and the business nature of non-limited. It is a challenge to make sure we're estimating that workload and the full-time equivalent positions appropriately for the work that's coming in. The bottom line is that we, because those positions are ones that are part of the non-limited budget, but we don't have funds that may be coming in to achieve the level of work that we may have projected. We have to ensure that we have productivity improvement as a way to ensure the processes are improved and that we deal with our cost in a way that reduces the cost and actually increases our productivity. What I'm getting at there is that the fees themselves are not increasing at the rate of inflation. And so, therefore, we have to ensure that we do some productivity improvement internally to make sure that we're competitive on our rates and can be a place where it will save money for the state, for our customers, whether local government, other ODOT divisions, or other state agencies, that they would want to come and use our services. So it's a situation of generally choice that people are coming and using that service, and therefore we need to be competitive. Condition of the fleet vehicles, like the situation on the roadways themselves, there's been some reduction in the condition of fleet vehicles. We've been pretty stable this last two-year period. We expect to have some potential reduction in the condition of fleet vehicles on the basis of the amount of money we expect to put here. There's a balance between, as Representative Schrader was alluding to, with the maintenance issues. We have maintaining the roadways compared to maintaining the vehicles. We'll try to get the balance of taking care of both within the assets that we have. Recruiting heavy diesel mechanics and mechanics in general is a difficult process. Hard to find qualified mechanics. Our folks have been very creative in recruiting and using interns, a new program, especially over at LeGrand, and other creative ways to try to get people into this field. It's one of those areas where there's fewer and fewer people going into this school. Same thing with engineers, as a matter of fact. I just read that the amount of people going into engineering schools have gone down 30% in recent years, and so the number of people coming out of those schools are a challenge to make sure we get them into our programs instead of going into private sector programs, which may pay better. Under the Oregon Transportation Infrastructure Fund, we're concerned about a funding source for modes other than highway and transit. Aeronautics, rail, and others do not have a fund source within that that statutory fund, and therefore don't have the opportunity for local governments or others to come and use that bank source for doing their projects. We need to think about other alternatives to that. Mr. Chair, if there aren't questions, I'll move into measures and outcomes that relate to the non-limited area.
Are there any questions? Representative Schrader.
Real quick, kind of a little bit backing up, but just to understand fully, the traffic signal services unit, how is that different than what the traffic safety division does in terms of providing signalization and the regional highway safety units? How is that different? How is their function different?
Mr. Chair, Representative Schrader, if you're talking about the traffic safety unit, traffic safety in terms of the division, puts out grants to local governments so they can buy various services, but does not do direct line installation and maintenance of traffic signals. So this would be the operating element of electricians and technicians who go out and actually do the work to install signals. I don't know if the members have ever stood next to a traffic signal. They look, when you're driving your car, they look like they're this big. When you stand next to them, they're about 4.5-5 feet high. They're large devices with a lot of, most of them are, with a lot of technical components, and sometimes it isn't worthwhile for local government to do all their own maintenance, so they'll contract with us since we have enough of them to justify it. I think we have just over 950 traffic control devices, some of which have Y2K issues, and we're working with those also. But that's the nature of the work. It's technical electricians' work. You have to have a qualified electrician on site to sign off on the work. And that's different than the traffic or the transportation safety function where grants are going to local governments for things that might involve cameras or traffic signals.
So it's just, yeah, so it's just repair?
Repair and installation.
And installation. Okay.
All right. If you want to continue, please.
Under page 4, dealing with outcomes, just briefly to talk about some of the efficiencies identified, particularly strong area of work has been looking at how to deal with reducing the supply of stock items. The fact is that we've got a lot of inventory in the past that we were working with and trying to reduce that inventory so that we could increase the efficiency of the process. We've gone to a just-in-time type inventory for those of you who have dealt with that type of inventory approach, which means we don't stock as much internally, and we get the items into inventory. We acquire them as we need them, which results in less time on managing, handling, and dealing with the material itself, and get the latest part or whatever it is out to the road instead of having to take a chance on items held in inventory. And that's saving us about $2 million. We eliminated underutilized vehicles. We've made the analysis of the vehicles we do have and ensured that the vehicles that we own and use are the ones that we need. We do lease some vehicles. And by getting moving off of underutilized vehicles, we've saved a significant amount of money, as shown. Also improve the fleet preventive maintenance scheduling by working to ensure that we have a schedule of preventive maintenance for each one of our vehicles and are doing that in a professional and business-like way, and instead of not dealing with them, tracking each one of their requirements over time. On the factors driving our costs, I think it's...
The question, what is your turnover then? What is your turnover rate for your inventory?
Turnover rate for inventory, meaning at what mileage rate?
2 months, 6 months, yearly.
Oh, some of it depends totally. We've got...
And what's the average, you mean?
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Representative Schrader, we go from dump trucks to sanders to graders, so each one has a different schedule, but I could provide you with something that maybe would give you some information about how that works. Some of them last for many, many years. Others may last for 5 to 6 years.
The dump trucks in your inventory?
Mr. Chair and Representative Schrader, yes. Hmm.
Well, not only the dump truck, but it's other forms of equipment. So it's just not dump trucks. It's a whole form of equipment inventory.
Mr. Chair, if you'd like to take a minute on the subject, then we have to bring Tom Luzer up and discuss it.
I guess I'm kind of confused. To me, inventory is usually an item that is a short, relatively short lifespan that's expendable, not a capital piece of equipment. So I guess I'm not familiar with what we're talking about.
Okay, let me clarify that first. When I was talking about supply inventory, I was talking about parts and not the inventory of heavy equipment. If we're talking about inventory of heavy equipment, we do have near 5,000 different kinds of vehicles, most of them are vehicles.
It's definitional, I think, is what we're dealing with here. I mean, I understand you've got a huge inventory of trucks that you use on a regular basis, but I'm talking about supplies in inventory like a business would have that you sell or get used up on a very regular basis, part of the ongoing operation.
Tom, here, what do I have here?
For the record, Tom Luther with ODOT. For Representative Schrader, there are several different things that we do have in inventory, and we're talking about inventory stock, not fleet equipment. And it's a wide variety. We have things such as forms, we have things such as license plates, titles, stickers. We also have an inventory of fleet equipment, parts, some of those that are extremely hard to get, some of those that are relatively available. You ask the average time frame for an inventory part, and I'd have to say it varies depending on what it is. The time frames for some of the parts dealing with the care of our rotary snowblowers are extremely difficult to get and very expensive. But we may have some of those on the shelf for a year or 2 years. Some of the other things like forms could be relatively short. License plates, because we do purchase in large quantities, we may purchase a 6 month or a year supply, so if they are there. So I'd have to say it's all over the board. But what we've attempted to do is to take from having a mega year supply down to something that's manageable and we can effectively deal with to meet our needs. We've reduced it down so that we are not losing inventory because of age. In other words, you buy a piece of equipment, you try not to get rid of the piece of equipment while still maintaining an inventory of stuff to look on that piece of equipment. So we're managing down to the very minimal amount of stock inventory that we possibly can.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Most businesses have, there's certain parameters, certain ratios you use to describe your inventory and your turnover rate to make sure you're doing it as efficiently as possible. And, I think, you don't want to buy a whole bunch of stuff at one time. 6 months may be an awful long time, quite frankly, for something like license plates. Unless you're getting some super great deal that you got to figure the interest on that. And just wanted to make sure that the Department of Transportation was operating on that same type of basis, and the ratios are comparable to other businesses, and it should be not to other public agencies, but to other businesses, as to how it might be done.
Okay. Thanks, Tom. I'm going to continue, Mike.
Yes, Mr. Chair, looking at the factors driving costs, I mentioned equipment inflation. An example is the dump truck where costs in 1996 were about $63,000 for a dump truck. They've gone up 44% in just over 2 years on the prices for those dump trucks. I think they're about $91,000 now. So a significant amount of inflation on some specialty items. Fuel cost fluctuations, I think all the members have seen the range of changing prices on fuel at about 25% range recently. Weather affects equipment usage. Heavy snows cause snow removal equipment to be used more than normal, and to some extent have maintenance issues. The fleet aging condition. As we have older units, there's obviously more maintenance to do and more work to keep them in working order. And then the changing business requirements. We have responsibilities now to make sure that when we're maintaining the highways that maintenance materials and debris do not get into and damage fish areas. So that's a consideration when we're out and dealing with the maintenance of our vehicles on the highway also. Mr. Chair, a few performance measures. I don't want to take too much of the committee's time, but just to give some perspective on the first shown there, the per unit of fleet equipment. We've been pretty stable on the average monthly cost recently, gone up about 1.2% since last biennium, so keeping it less than the cost of inflation. Stock inventory, as Tom mentioned, was significantly down, which results in reduced costs and storage and handling. I think it's down about 45% in terms of the number of stock items that we have there, which, as I say, does reduce the work involved on tracking and managing it. The fleet condition, mentioned earlier, we're trying to maintain that stable. It went up slightly in terms of condition in this last biennium. We're expecting, hoping to hold stable or slight reduction in this next biennium. And on the fleet work order value, which talks about the value of the work that we're doing, the value of the work, the acquisition of products, showing that we've gone up in the value of work by a significant amount there. But at the same time, we've had less work orders, which means we're trying to be more efficient in terms of the number of work orders as compared to the value of the work that we're accomplishing. All that within a pretty stable number of FTE positions involved. Mr. Chair, if there aren't questions on this piece, I'll move to...
Are there any questions by the committee members?
Did we get an FTE overlay on the stock inventory trends like we've done on the fleet work order value?
We can get one. FTE for the stock inventory. And that will relate to the positions that are moving in terms of the decision package or program option package that relates to us moving positions in and out of non-limited. We can relate to that.
Okay. Aren't there positions just that are related to the inventory division or whatever?
Correct.
Right.
Senator Yee.
Senator,
Senator
Yee, I have a question on your chart on fleet condition. So you mean for December 1998, the fleet condition that's good is 42.7%?
Mr. Chair, Senator Yee, that's correct. If we were to total those and look at trying to go towards what's fair or better, in other words, what's not poor, we would have, I think, 66.4% was fair or better in a year and a half ago, and now we're at 68% is fair or better. So the Senator is correct. If you kind of look at the right side of the amount that's poor, those percentages have gone down slightly, about 1.6% since June of 97, meaning that we have slightly higher percentage of fair or better fleet condition.
Okay.
Yes, please.
And so 32% of your fleet condition is poor in December 98.
Mr. Chair, Senator Yee, correct.
And what is the goal? What is the department's goal?
Senator Hannon and Senator Yee, our goal is to make sure we're maintaining at the current level. It's been a balancing act, as I mentioned earlier, to try to take care of our equipment and yet recognize that the department's frontline mission is to maintain the highways. So our goal is to try to balance a goal of a certain level of fair or better on the condition of the pavement, and to achieve that goal and at the same time to try to maintain a stable level of the condition of our fleet. We felt it inappropriate to have the fleet in perfect shape and not have the roadways in perfect shape, so we're trying to get that balance.
The fleet, yes. Mr. Chairman. Fleet is your tools to maintain roads in good condition. So you have to make sure the fleet condition is good in order for you to do a good job in the maintenance. And I thought 32% poor is pretty high.
Mr. Chair, I'll let Tom take a shot at that.
For the record, Tom moves with ODOT. Chair Andrew, Senator Yee. Our standard for our fleet that we would have in poor condition is 20% or under. That's our target. And we say that because in many cases, the equipment that we do have has very low utilization except on an emergency basis. And so when some of the equipment gets old or aged, we put it into an area like a stockpile site, where we'd have a loader there that's worked very few hours per winter to load sand when it's needed. So it wouldn't make good sense to replace that with a brand new piece of equipment when an older one will meet the needs. So our target is 20%
of the operating items.
Correct.
Oh, but you're part of it below your goal.
Correct.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chair, what do you define as a condition, a poor condition vehicle then?
We try to still operational. Sure. We try to identify different categories of fleet equipment so that we can track and see where we are as kind of a thumbnail sketch of the condition. And we've identified it in several different categories. The first would be in good condition, whereby it meets our criteria for replacement, and that would be it's within the age standards for replacement. And it's within the mileage standards for replacement. If it meets both those criteria, it's good. If it meets one of those criteria, let's say that the replacement standard is 5 years and it's 7 years old, but it has low miles, it would fall in the fair condition. If it falls into the poor category, it doesn't meet either category.
Okay.
So really,
pretty high standards, eh?
Yeah, they.
No, I was just trying to keep two people.
Yeah.
Senator Q-Tub.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So really, the standards, what we would consider poor, is probably not at all the same thing that you consider poor, because all you're saying is that it has high mileage and it's old. Doesn't mean that it doesn't operate. It sounds like to me the way you describe that. Is that correct?
Senator Ann. Senator Q-Tub, I would say that we are now using a variety of categories in addition to age and miles. We also track repair costs for each piece of equipment. If the repair costs are extremely high, that's also something that's worthy of replacing it. We also have partnered with Oregon State University to put together a replacement model that brings into consideration the return on investment. So it gives you an idea of the most opportune time to replace a piece of equipment.
Oh, excuse me.
I could just follow up with one other question. I had a question about the program that is, I don't know if it's called Comet, but it's a program in, it's something that the Department of Transportation has in I know, in Portland, where they respond to get somebody who's been either in an accident or the car falls or something, and they're on the side of the road and they're actually creating a backup in traffic. Those pieces of equipment, are they owned by ODOT? Or do you
contract out to do that.
And Sarkeetab, those pieces of equipment, I believe, were purchased with federal funds.
Oh.
And they are in our fleet, and we do maintain them, track them, track costs, and so on.
Representative Schrader? Okay. Any other questions by committee members? Not Mike, if you'd like to continue, please.
Okay, let's go on to the next page, Mr. Chair. Page 5, just talking a little bit more about the accomplishments. In the interest of time, I'll just select a few of those. One is that the Oregon Transportation Infrastructure Fund did get up and running in this last biennium with a wide series of projects. Just a few examples would be City of Independence, Ash Creek Bridge replacement, City of Hood River, a vehicle maintenance facility, Washington County, Murray Boulevard Bridge widening. There have been several of those that are in progress or that have been completed.
Is that an ongoing revolving fund that says to the city, here's some initial money to go out and develop a project, and then they pay back, and when they pay back, then you loan the money out again to some other city or county?
Yes, Chair hit the nail on the head. That's exactly what it is. It's got $12 million of fund assets, and they're used to try to meet the need of those who indicate the strongest requests. And we have several, I think there are probably about 7 or 8 loans that are in process right now being requested. So we try to do it in a way that meets the best return on the investment and meets the highest level of need in the local government.
What is the net yield to the state on behalf of the money that is loaned to local government? Is there an interest rate on yield? Or is it just flat payback?
Mr. Chair, we do have an interest rate, yes. I can't quote which it is right now. I believe it is around 5%, but I'll get back to the chair with that.
Okay.
Other areas would be absorbing inflation with no increase in rate. As I mentioned earlier, we're ensuring that we're not increasing our rates. The only area of potential increase will be as we improve our true product cost and through our cost accounting system and make sure that we're including all areas of overhead to make sure those are included. Reducing the number of fleet units. In 1990, we had about 5,200 units. Now we have 4,700, so about a 10% reduction. And as Tom mentioned, we've worked with OSU to establish a strategic plan for fleet replacement. We've done the same thing with facilities to make sure that we're putting the money in for the best return on the investment, dealing with all fleet components, and targeting and prioritizing according to that return on investment. For 1999, 2001, we'll be marketing more with local governments to ensure an understanding of the OTIF and the revolving fund asset and resource that's available there. Cross-training on intelligent transportation systems, which means the ramp metering and other systems where we can make sure we provide the service in the most efficient way. Continuing to absorb the inflation with no increases in charges through internal productivity increases and process improvement. And then working on the multi-state fleet acquisition program, if I can say it. Reduce costs and workload for each of the state agencies involved in purchasing equipment. And then the new fleet motor pool in Bend, where ODOT owns the land and the Department of Administrative Services owns the facility. And we'll have a partnership there, saving money for both agencies as well as for state agencies that are using that facility in general, and it'll also have a 24-hour fueling service available. Here, move on to the budget discussion.
Sure. Representative Schrader.
What about leasing programs and leasing equipment, either at the state level or encouraging locals to do that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Schrader, we do lease some vehicles, and we also lease a significant number of vehicles, in essence, lease them from the Department of Administrative Services. When we're talking about basic sedan kind of work, I think we lease about 168 vehicles from the Department of Administrative Services. So when it's not a specialty vehicle, the vast majority of our work, 95% of the vehicles that are in our stock are specialty vehicles from the dump trucks to the graders to the whatever. So we don't maintain things that we can get easily through DAS or through another mechanism. In terms of working with the private sector on leasing, I know that We at the state level provide a lot of service to local governments, both DAS for the standard sedans and us in working with local governments who don't have a certain type of equipment, and to make sure that it's efficient for that local government, they will come to us many times and ask to borrow our piece of equipment. We try to track that and keep track of what we're loaning out and what we're getting back, so it's a fair situation to the State Highway Fund. At the same time, we try to really be helpful to local government, because it makes no sense for an entity that needs snowplow equipment 3 days a year to go out and acquire one, or even to go out to the private sector, if we can work it out to have a loan situation. So we try to have a good, solid working relationship with local government to meet that kind of need.
Is anything given to local government, say, like, instead of monetary, in lieu of services, expertise, drafting, engineering? Are those services provided to local government in lieu of a direct financial contribution?
Mr. Chair, there's a lot of in lieu of partnership going on, both for people time as well as equipment time, but we do try to keep track of that and understand what's going where, so that it isn't getting out of proportion, and that we are protecting the State Highway Fund.
Is that in the non-limited account?
Some of it's in the non-limited account, some of it is not. We do, within the non-limited area, that work on traffic control devices or the maintenance of equipment. There are things and agreements that occur. Some of those are very explicit, though, where we do the work, but it's a specific invoice and charge. Other elements where we may loan a dump truck for 1 day to a city would be something that the local maintenance crew keeps track of, and they make sure that there's some kind of fair consideration coming back the other way at some other point. So it's very clearly something that we do on a significant basis. And then there are other areas within light design where engineers do specific work, again, that's build, and we're paid directly for that, because there isn't a perception of an ability to come back and have a give and take on that one like there is with a local dump truck.
Representative Butler?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mike, relative to the lease of heavy equipment, such as the patrols, graders, dozers, blades, loaders, and those kinds of things, we're buying on that leasing on that most preferential schedule, I assume, and do we strictly depend upon DAS to always make sure that that's the case, or do we get direct proposals then that we actually receive with the Department of Transportation?
Mr. Chair and Representative Butler, when you say DAS, you're not referring to the sedans and vehicle fleets that they have that we use. You're talking about the purchase process that's used.
Okay, so
I'm asking you. You're talking about the purchasing process for how we acquire. Do we work through DAS? The answer is yes.
Okay, and that's with regard to the heavy equipment as well, and that's is that by and large leased, or is that by and large purchased by DAS?
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, it depends on the equipment. We do have a buyback program that we initiated, and we think has a lot of potential for savings, where we can, in essence, lease and then have an opportunity to purchase when we get to a point where we feel like it has the best return.
I have two other lines of questions. One, with regard to your cooperative agreements with local cities and counties. I know that we've done that successfully in some cities and counties, but sometimes the documents are somewhat onerous to put those together. And you talk about when they need a truck, we'll go down and get them a truck, and then we'll have some quid pro quo before long back and forth. Are all of those still done by these very lengthy documents that go on for inch after inch, or is that pretty much done at the local manager's option?
Mr. Chair and Representative Butler, it depends on the how ongoing the relationship and the magnitude of the situation. I think there are some maintenance sites where it's very unusual that we have that kind of partnering, and it's done on a more informal basis. But where we've clearly said that we're going to have a significant dependency on the ODOT equipment, we have had a relatively significant review, which includes an expectation of some administrative costs to maintain it. I understand what the representative is talking about. We're trying to work to make sure that we have a shared understanding of overhead costs. Has been one of the concerns where a local government may say that we have in our local government a certain level of administration, ODOT has another level. By getting our food product cost, our cost accounting system in, I think we can answer the questions about what it should be, and then make sure that we have an apples-to-apples comparison.
Okay, fine, thank you. And one final question, yes. Mr. Chair. You'd mentioned the comment about sharing graphing and the CAD-CAM equipment and so forth, and I know that you have a great deal of that. Also know that through our correction system in the state that we have a great deal of CAD-CAM equipment that's presently being used within the corrections departments. I think that you're sharing currently some signs that they're making signs for you and those other kinds of things through these sign shops. Are you sharing also any of the CAD-CAM equipment? Are we actually having prison labor do some of that as much as they possibly can based upon the field specs that are being brought to them by surveyors from the state?
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, regarding the sign shop, we are using the Department of Corrections for what we call stock signs and have had some contracts with them to get those stock signs done. When it requires specialty kinds of overlay of the type of sign, again, these signs that when you drive by them fast don't seem to be very complex, but some of them have some requirements, especially from the federal government, that require specialty equipment that Corrections doesn't have. And so in those cases, we've done them ourselves. In terms of working with Department of Corrections on the design work, I'm not familiar with CAD-CAM work that has been done with the Department of Corrections. I'll turn around and see if there's any information on that one real quickly.
Sure, Hannon. President Butler. One of the hats that I do wear was given to me by Director Cunningham, and that's to provide a working relationship with the Department of Corrections. And one of the things that we have done is put together a series of partnerships, one dealing with as constructed drawings. We do have an agreement in place with Corrections to spend up to $100,000 a year for a one-year period to take and use inmates to do CAD work to reconstruct our as constructed drawings. So we are entering into that partnership with them, and it's been pretty impressive.
And just yeah. To follow up, and relative back to the signs, and I sorry to belabor that point, but that there are some specialized signs that you must do in-house because there's a certain piece of equipment that only you have that is not presently available in our sign shop at the at Corrections. Is that something that we may be able to go ahead and provide the equipment over to the Department of Corrections, and then they can produce that? I understand that our sign shop has capacity of about two or three times more than what it's presently producing, and if that extra piece of equipment to put the federal border around it or whatever it is were made available to the Corrections Department, then they could provide that sign for you as well?
Sure, and Representative Butler, we have entered into an agreement to produce some of the standard signs with the Department of Corrections out of the Powder River facility, and they have provided those. To give you a response to transfer all of the equipment to them, I think you would have to consider cost, location, immediate delivery, demand, and things like that. I would prefer that we would continue the dialogue with Corrections and continue working with them to produce the overflow signs that we can't produce, or some of the signs that are much easier for them.
No,
it doesn't answer my question, and we'll just follow up. I get a sneaking suspicion that, based upon what I've seen, and now we've got equipment also at Powder River, the equipment which I've seen at the minimum security and at SRCI, there's probably $500,000 or $700,000 worth of equipment. I'm not sure what kind of a border is necessary for fast feed U.S. Interstate highway signs, but whatever kind of a border, whatever kind of a background those need, I would say that for a very minimal price, and I guess when we're talking about a shop that's vacant 70% of the time because it doesn't have enough sign orders, if you're talking about the fact that the sign can't be ordered on Monday and delivered on Friday, if you're doing a better job than that from your own shop, then maybe that's an issue, but we need to recognize also that daily the network travels the entire state, so I've got a sneaking suspicion that any sign that you would want on Cannon Beach, if you could fax them the order for it today, that probably tomorrow afternoon that beach could be, that beach sign could be being hung. But if it requires a special federal border on it for high speed travel down Cannon Beach, then probably we would need the equipment. So I guess what I'm asking is, can we work a little closer with those folks, and can we maybe utilize the sign shop, which the state already owns, which is only being 30% utilized?
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, as Tom says, we've been working with them. We'll expand that discussion to make sure we understand what their costs would be to provide a service at a higher level, so we can make that decision on the basis of the analysis.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Questions or committee members?
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, Grace Koenig, for the record, if I could go back and just add something to Representative Butler. I wasn't sure in the exchange that some of the what goes on was actually documented here, and I wanted to make sure I wasn't off base with where the legislature wants us to be. It's been my, the issue of intergovernmental agreements, I have very much encouraged the staff to do things on handshakes. They've been doing that for some time. And I don't mean everything on a handshake. We do have to look out after the Highway Trust Fund and make sure that it's two things. One, that the money's not used on anything that's not the highway. And people, you know, cities and counties get into pickles, don't have equipment, and so we have to just make sure we're repaid. If it's repaid by other funds, then we've made the trust fund whole. And the other issue we have is protection of the state highway dollars as opposed to cities and counties, so that we're not in any part of the state subsidizing a county in some fashion or vice versa, the citizens of that county. So I've encouraged handshakes, but they keep account of it, and at the end of the month, public works director or city manager, depending on the size of the city, calls back and they make a note of what's there and they square up in a reasonable period of time. So I think that that helps and that that's a fair way to proceed in the state. You can get awfully technical, and Mike's right, we do have a range of times when we have those agreements, but there's quite a bit of handshakes out there. I think there were quite a bit of handshakes before I got there, but it wasn't encouraged. Before I got there, I think they were sort of behind the scenes, and I said, own up to it, it's a good thing. So if that's not where people want to head, I need to know that, because it's been a kind of an active encouragement in partnership. So I think we can get a better return for everybody's buck that way.
Representative Butler.
You're absolutely correct, and I do appreciate the fact that there have been more, in recent times, more handshake-type agreements. The concern that I do have is that I hope that during the last year to 18 months it's gotten much better, because and I want you to know that I do come from a county, as you're well aware, Grace, I come from a county background, and I always felt like that when the state did anything for us, whether it was striping or whatever, we always tried to give 1.5 to 2 miles back when the state would do something. In other words, we tried to contribute more than what, because we were in a pickle, and we always felt very grateful for the equipment that the state did have, but we also became aware that where we had one of these 2-inch documents, that it was much easier when we had a broken down water truck. It was much easier to get the water truck for South County because of the owner's document that we had that said, you know, keep track of the hours and the people and this and that and the other, than it was for us in Niagara County, as we were in the process of doing a road and lost the transmission in our water truck, to go and say, can we borrow your water truck, you know, for this particular project, which would be 2 days, and then, you know, charge us whatever you want. We don't have one, and ours in Jordan Valley had a transmission out, and so, you know, the problem was that we just couldn't do it. I mean, the district manager said no. The fact that we've got 3 of them lined up back here that are empty, that aren't going to be used, the answer is no, you don't have an agreement. And so what we ended up doing was we ended up going to the Bureau of Land Management and working out as best we could for a day or two to get through the project, and then immediately entering into another agreement to get the other piece of equipment at a rather substantial expense. So I guess my concern is that again, the local folks have a latitude for those emergency one-time kinds of things, and then and then hold the feet to the fire. Make sure that the local people reciprocate with quid pro quo and plus, because we really appreciate it to have the opportunity to have this vast yard of equipment, just one piece of it, available to us when we're broken down and can't finish a project, when we've got chip and seal ready to go on but don't have a water truck.
Chairman Hannon, Representative Butler, I think either by agreement or by handshake you should have gotten help from ODOT in that situation. And the repayment happens is important to all the other taxpayers in the other counties. There are some counties that are better equipped than we are. In some cases, we're better equipped than the county. Whatever the situation, I think the partnership helps. And if in that case the agreement would have helped to promote that, that's fine. We are trying to empower as much as we can at the local level with providing statewide guidelines. And in that case, probably a discussion with them on the cooperation would have been in order there, whether it would be a by agreement or, you know, for handshake.
Representative Patrick.
I was late for committee today because I was set to find out a bill, and it's the exact same thing. We have House Bill 3465, which is being sent to us from our committee that passed out of Bob Montgomery's committee this morning. That was at the request of Jackson County. There's a partnershiping agreement that was done between ODOT and Jackson County there in Jackson County. There's been some concerns over that. The feasibility study was done. The feasibility study showed that if there was an actual merger between the departments, that there would be some cost savings. There's some issues regarding, you know, the union and union rules and how those contracts are working. What Representative Montgomery's committee did is put together and form a task force to figure out how we can merge the two entities and do that in other areas of the state. The Oregon Public Employees Union came in and supported that after we put that agreement together. The county's happy with that. ODOT's happy with that. And hopefully we're going to move forward so we have some kind of a more stabilized vehicle for some of this partnershiping, and that task force can work out some of the issues with everyone at the table. So I think ODOT's been very progressive in looking at that, and the county's been pushing that, and I think, you know, if we can deal with some of the union and management issues, which are of some concern, the unions are both willing to come to the table, though, on this one, and both of them endorse this proposal. That's what I said.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Yee.
Is this merger of the County Road Department and Transportation Maintenance Department?
Correct.
Also,
like in Jackson County, where the County Road Department and ODOT share equipment and share manpower.
And maintain roads together?
Maintain roads together, the sharing of equipment, so ODOT doesn't need to have three dump trucks in Jackson County, and the county has three dump trucks, and three of the dump trucks aren't being used all the time. You can share the equipment, you can share some of the equipment, you can share some of those things. And hopefully it's going to put more money on the roads instead of into, you know, equipment that may sit idly sometimes because you're moving between pieces of equipment to do various projects. And also as you drive down the road, you can fill the pothole in the county road as on your way to the state road to fill the pothole instead of driving over.
What's out the cost share allocation of the cost?
Right, and that's what the task force has set up to put together, how we would do that, because it needs to occur at a legislative level.
Okay, great.
Senator Hannon and Senator Yee and Representative Patrick, we have a range of counties out there, and in some counties we have a relationship than with others. And some counties were not wanted at all, for the most part. And so we really have tried to push this county partnership and local government partnership. We'll be reaching out to the cities here shortly, as far as we can in different areas. And we, in Jackson County, we have a joint work program. We have taken all of the roads, and we are managing all of the roads in the county and the state, not the city roads at this point, but the city is very interested. So that we actually have you manage the
we manage the work of Jackson County with the Jackson County roads and the ODOT roads as one, and we look at the total workforce, the total equipment. And I think it makes a lot of sense, but we have a county who wants to do that. We're not trying to force ourselves on any county there. Every county's in a little bit different position, so it's a good opportunity for us, and it's worked well down there. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Any other questions? Mike, if you want to continue, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Move on to page 6 of the handout dealing with the budget. It's a relatively simple summary. Although the total is pretty stable, there are three major changes, and those relate to the program option packages. If you look at the first line, the debt service and infrastructure fund is up significantly. That's because of the consolidation of debt service from other programs, so that comes into the non-limited area. The second one under operations relates to the shift of the materials lab from operations to highway, so that's reduced. The third item there, $27 million current biennium, $39 million next biennium, is not the result of really a reduction, but rather an overestimate. A significant amount of that is the overestimate of insurance assessments from Department of Administrative Services. Those have been made accurate, and the next time we'll have a lower level there, so that's the reduction there. Mr. Chair, I'll go to staffing on page 7 if there aren't questions on that. We have a decrease of 35 and a half positions approximately, and again, that is because of the shift both ways. The 11 positions that come into the non-limited area for the reprographics, photography, etc. shop, the supply positions that are going out, 2 positions, the shift of the materials lab to highway, which results in the 40 positions being shifted out, and the total coming to the net effect of the 31.58 positions of all POPs. So, Mr. Chair, that's the budget portion of non-limited. There are 2 other elements outside of our own program. One is light rail, which I'll go to if there aren't any questions about the ODOT program.
Before you do, on your FTEs here, where you're putting some in central services and some in non-limited, the net effect is, as I count this, there's 46 46 FTE being eliminated in exchange for 11 FTE that are being created. Is that
correct, Mr. Chair? And if there are 11 positions coming in and the 44.58.
Now, the question I have is, of the 46 FTE, are they being switched to something else? So on one side of the ledger, it shows a reduction, but we pick them up later on another side.
Mr. Chair, yes. The others are being shown. The members may remember the discussion within the central services area about graphics and the fact that we have the loss of that unit from central services. And the supply positions is showing the gaining of those 2 positions in central services, so it is a shift that's balanced within the department.
So the effect is it's not a net loss of 46 positions?
Correct, Mr. Chair.
Okay. I wanted the committee to understand that, because not everything's as it seems. It's worth dealing with a complicated budget like this. Sometimes we think we're eliminating something when in fact all we're doing is creating the position to some other function.
Mr. Chair, it's being done strictly because of the accounting issue.
Yeah.
Is the 4 FTE that are being absorbed through reclassification, those positions are going away because the dollars have been shifted to positions?
Correct. On those 4 positions, they are not shifting. Those are ones that have been eliminated and used for other purposes.
That's the absorption of reclassification?
Correct.
Okay. Further questions? If not, I guess you want to begin on light rail?
We'd like to hit that briefly, Mr. Chair. Light rail is the next page in the handout.
Okay.
And I want to make very clear that this is debt service that flows through the ODOT budget. It is not an ODOT program. We don't have discretion about it. The legislature made a prior decision to use state bonds and lottery funds for Westside Light Rail. That decision was previously made. The funds were used. There was nothing from the state highway fund or ODOT revenues that were used in that project, but it is paid through the ODOT budget, so it's shown here. What we're doing is, in this current biennium, the funds went up because there was refinancing. So the bonds were actually paid off in the current biennium and then refinanced at a better rate. And so that's why we continue the payments into the future. The final payment would be due in 2010. The lottery fund monies have been brought in the past and expected to be brought in the future at $10 million a year to make those payments. Mr. Chair, I'm open to questions on that.
Okay. Are there any questions on light rail? The state's participation. If not?
Mr. Chair, I'll move to capital improvements. Within the operating portion of our budget, in terms of capital improvements to our facilities, that's what's included within this budget. The capital construction is included in a separate bill, which I understand there may be a capital construction subcommittee or at least some mechanism for the Ways and Means Committee to deal with capital construction separately from this bill. Our bill involves a capital improvements, which are defined as those that are below $500,000 for total cost of an individual project. Those that are over $500,000 are capital construction. If you look at the information about 1997-99, there's zeros in the column for capital improvements. For 99-01, shows our request. The reality is that in the current biennium, we consolidated capital construction and capital improvements, and it totaled $19.2 million. In the consolidated budget request for 1999-2001, the consolidated amount for capital improvements and capital construction is $8.5 million. So we have less budgeted than the current biennium in terms of the consolidated amount. We are emphasizing in this biennium maintaining what we have. We're trying to take care of the assets that we currently have, and so the projects that are listed are to take care of our 1,000 buildings that are part of the inventory at ODOT, as well as working with leases that we have that are approximately 101.
Senator Duke.
Take the airport amount. What kind of money is that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Duke, that is aeronautics money, not highway fund money. And to give some perspective about those projects, it's at the Condon State Airport, where there's construction of an apron in their agricultural operations area, and the Wasco State Airport, Flurry Seal on the runway. And those are from the aeronautics funds. Looking through a few of the issues, I did indicate that we're trying to emphasize the maintenance of the existing buildings and deal with deferred maintenance and make sure we're taking care of what we have. So we don't have a major emphasis this biennium on new construction. I did a lot of projects in the current biennium, both with Americans with Disabilities projects to allow for access to buildings as well as other projects. We improved 22 of the schools in 1999-2001 would be to improve 22 highway maintenance facilities, as well as the work at motor carrier and the airport I just mentioned. As far as the highlights for what the plan is for the future, we don't have any program option packages in this area, no FTE increase. As I mentioned before, the focus is on highway preservation. We try to do a balance of taking care of our facilities while at the same time taking care of the highway. And Mr. Chair, I can give examples of a project that the members would like, but that's the summary on capital improvement.
Okay. Are there any other questions?
Mike, the bill for 99-2001 airport, $499,200 improvements, but in the chart it shows $2.6 million improvements. Why the difference?
Mr. Chair and Senator Yee, I'm looking at the airport portion of the budget request for 1999-2001 is $499,300 in the chart. Are you seeing a component that looks like
a difference? I see a component of the $2.6 million. I mean, why isn't it included in your goals?
The facilities. The airports are the $499,300. Other facilities, which mean the 1,000 buildings, and we're particularly targeting 22 maintenance facilities, would be the other one. So airports is one line for $499, and the facilities are other structures that are facilities, buildings that ODOT has. So one is $2.6 million for the facilities, the other is $499,000 for the airport.
Oh, they're not both for airport.
Correct.
One for airport, the other one are ODOT facilities.
Correct.
All right.
Ms. Gordon.
Marsh, you might explain the difference between this facilities number here and the facilities policy package in the maintenance budget for deferred maintenance.
Happy to do so, Mr. Chair and Ms. Jordan. The facilities definitions are that within our operating budget, we do the basic maintenance work. So we had a package in the operating budget for central services to do to get caught up on some painting, on some cracks in the structures, some very basic repair work. This is the kind of work that's done on an ongoing basis and in accounting terms is part of the operating budget. Capital improvements mean you're making an improvement to the facility that is you have to track as an improvement in the asset. So it's not just day-to-day painting. Day-to-day painting will be part of the regular budget for the agency and needs to be included in the operating budget that you've already seen. Capital improvements are those kinds of improvements that relate to improving a structure by putting in a fire sprinkling system or fixing a major roof problem, not just putting in a couple of pieces of the roof, but making a replacement of the entire roof. And so it's a major piece of work and has to be a capital improvement approved within this part of the budget.
Okay. Further questions? Thank you, Mike, for your presentation on that.
You bet. Thank you, Mr. Chair. That ends our discussion of the non-limited portion of the budget. Mr. Chair, I'm not sure if our
presenter is not here, and we're going to... Pardon me?
We have two options, Mr. Chair. We can go to our discussion of the zero-based budget.
Yeah, that's what Ms. Jordan was going to explain to the committee members, the concept of what the zero-based budgeting is, what it looks like, what we can anticipate looking at in the way of numbers, and what we're going to be addressing. So, Ms. Gordon, would you like to hand out your information on the numbers, please?
And while I'm doing that, you might ask staff if they have any comments about the last two items.
Okay. Then, Gilbert, do you want to come back? Is there anything else that you want to add from the last presentation?
Mr. Chair, thank you. Lynn Gilbert, Department of Administrative Services. I have not prepared a handout on the last two presentations. This is in line with the governor's budget, reflects the governor's budget, and staff recommended it.
Are there any questions by committee members of staff? Okay, if not, would you like me to give us a little background here on zero-based budgeting?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jamie handed out to you an outline of the zero-based budget review concept that we discussed. I worked out with ODOT to present to the committee when we talked about whether we could effectively do a review at this level. And the department will be presenting to you three different levels that will give you some idea of what's in their budget at, from a semi-zero-based look. It's not a true zero-based budget review because we're not starting at the first dollar and building up from there. What we've asked them to do is to develop packages that reflect what their first level would be, what their legal obligations are, and those are contractual obligations or mandated services that they're required to do no matter what, and what FTE and what dollars it would take to do that, and they'll describe that to you. And then from there, the second level we ask them to look at would be their critical needs. Those are the kinds of things that they're required to do in their department to meet their fiduciary obligations, providing critical support, the life, health, and safety issues that are inherent in their business, what they have to do to protect their assets and reduce fixed costs, and they will describe that to
And then from that point on, they will talk about the 5% increments on policy packages that they have presented in the governor's budget. And the two areas that we are going to review are the highway maintenance area and central services. So it is not the entire budget, it's just two units of the department that we're experimenting with here. And does the committee have any questions about that?
Okay, thank you. Are there any questions by committee members?
Mr. Chairman, we have a bill on this, isn't it, that requires transportation department to do zero-based budget.
That's separate from this discussion, yeah.
This discussion was started by the co-chairs of Ways and Means responding to some of our colleagues' questions about trying to get a better handle and identification on ODOT funding. The request initially would have zero-based the entire budget down to zero and rebuild it from first dollar up. The concern that was expressed by committee and ODOT was the fact that we didn't have the time to go into depth such magnitude that we would take the entire budget and start from the beginning with it. So then it was identified by the co-chairs that we take a couple elements out of the budget and zero-base those and see how we do and see if we can recapture some of the intent and issues associated with those two functions. So while you're mentioning the bill, Senator, that is an issue that is separate from this because this is something that the co-chairs and the leadership have both agreed that they want to do in this session. Regardless of the bill.
Because I'm just wondering, Mr. Chairman, if we're getting ready for the bill.
No, this was started long before the bill even arrived.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay.
Mr. Chair, this is for the benefit of the committee to take a look at these parts of the budget in a different, from a different perspective.
Mm-hmm.
An opportunity to ask different questions that you might not otherwise.
Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just two observations in that regard. Number one, I think those of us who wanted to have a greater degree of influence, control, access to the actual ODOT budget process, probably, speaking solely for myself at this point, probably really didn't know, understand, and appreciate a relationship with Mike Marsh, who I believe, you know, we've been able to hear and work with and gain a greater degree of confidence in. And number two, particularly, again, speaking for myself, never having had the opportunity to see the level of accountability of the actual employees who work at the shops, on the road, at the various jobs that carry the shovels that fill the holes, the accountability that each one of them know what the other guy costs if he's not carrying his weight, I think gave me a much greater level of appreciation. And so when we come back and say, let's do the whole department this way versus let's go ahead and experiment and see if, and I think what we have here is that we have also Mr. Marsh coming online and saying, perhaps it might work. Let's go ahead and do a couple of the budgets on zero base. If it appears that it gives you better information, us better information, we can become better legislators, we can become better Department of Transportation operators, managers, controllers, then at that particular point maybe we can do more of it. So
after your drive behind the ears, I'll introduce you to the real Mike Burke.
Oh, okay.
Well, thank you.
You can't
miss the same
thing.
I know that's checking behind your ears too.
I couldn't help that. You set me up for it.
I introduced you to that.
Hey, Jerry, I was curious if you know why Central Services was
I don't know. That was done in consultation with the co-chairs and the speaker and the Senate president, and they were trying to identify a couple areas in which a zero-based budget and would not keep us here until September. And so I don't know the process for selection other than the fact that they looked at two of the areas and they said maybe we ought to centralize or look at the centralized cost and identify that. And the highway maintenance, you know, those are things that are targeted as doable in the time given for us to work. Ms. Gordon, you want to comment?
Mr. Chair, Senator Duke, I believe that part of the reason that these two areas were selected, one is the maintenance area was identified by the Efficiency Committee as an area that would be a good place to start with a zero-based review. And then administration has been an issue, and simple services is the closest finite area that you could get to looking at administration. So that was one of the reasons why the co-chair chose to look at areas to begin with.
So beyond that, it's above my job description.
Okay.
But that's the direction that the leadership on both sides has given to us. So that we'd like to delve in and get some real meat and substance. Senator Timms was on the Efficiency Committee and apparently came away from the last interim with some serious questions on what we're doing, why and how, and has asked that we try to accommodate that as much as possible.
I don't think you're going to find too much moss under these two rocks, but
okay.
I'm certainly willing to help out.
Okay. Now, the handout Ms. Jordan gave can be part of your information for tomorrow. ODOT handed out some information on the zero-based budgeting. We'll probably get in more of this in depth tomorrow. Now, we are having some public testimony tomorrow morning first thing, and then after that after a public testimony then we'll be back to the possible hearing work session, and I'd like to do it when we can target in on the zero-based budgeting without having to interrupt it, but start it after the public presentation tomorrow, because I'd like to keep the public presentation short and to the point.
Yeah, would you like to have a brief overview on zero-based budgeting right
well,
now?
We'll take it tomorrow, Mike. Your director of the Board of Maritime Pilots is here, and since it's a small section and we have about 20 minutes left, I'd like to move and capture their part of the budget if we can.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Linda Gilbert, you want to come back up? Susan Johnson, welcome. Linda, do you have some opening comments to make?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, Linda Gilbert, Department of Administrative Services. This will be very brief. You have a handout on the Board of Maritime Pilots, front and back. The governor's revised budget is $282,000. It's a 6% increase over $97.99 legislatively approved. This is due to inflation and state services priceless adjustments. There are no other significant increases. Moving to the second page, to the back of the page, there is one technical adjustment in the governor's revised budget, and it's an accounting adjustment to shift $13,415 from limited to non-limited. The reason it needs to be in limited and non-limited is that it's a budget area for rate hearings. The money is paid by the parties involved in the hearings. It's highly unpredictable type of activity, and using several years ago, the legislation determined that it would be easier to use a non-limited accounting function for this and eliminate having to make trips to the emergency board. Other questions?
Are there any questions on this, Representative Patrick?
Well, let them present their budget.
Okay. Thank you, Linda.
For the record, my name is Susan Johnson. I'm the administrator for the Board of Maritime Pilots. We're a licensing board and regulate pilots for bringing the vessels in and out of the state. It's become more obvious how important their job is, given the recent events within the Carissa. I'd like to just go over very briefly what the board has been doing over the last biennium. Hopefully, and thankfully, we've been able to get to things that are a lot more important, too, the occupational licensing of the pilots and furthering their training to keep up with newer technologies that are coming online with the vessels, bridge resource management, interactions with foreign crews, multilingual crews. It makes their jobs much more difficult when trying to advise masters and crews on directing the vessels to get them safely through the port. So more recently, we've developed a program of continuing professional development that's coming online this next biennium so that we can further the training of our pilots through manned model training exercises, which take them through worst-case scenarios without having to damage environment or other vessels. They're smaller types of vessels that they can practice on with worst-case scenarios. They devise scenarios where they get into extremist situations, and it's up to them to decide how to address those situations. It's a very good training program.
Still limited entry system on marine pilots?
So it used to be
you had to buy your way in or something and get a position because there was X amount of licenses, and so you actually bought your way into becoming a marine pilot.
I'm not really aware of that system existing. I have been here approximately 5.5 years, and in that time, the board has developed an apprentice training program for the Columbia and Willamette River piloted system to allow equal access. Currently, we have an apprentice training in that program, and she will be hopefully finished with that by October this year, and then we'll go on to train for licensure. The number of licenses available is essentially limited by the amount of shipping coming in and out of the state. There are only a certain number of vessels coming in and out, and so it's the number of licenses to serve those ships is based on an FTE. So at this current time, we now have 44 licensees for the Columbia and Willamette River system. We had 22 pilots licensed on the Columbia River bar. That now has been reduced to 20 licenses in recognition of a helicopter transfer system that's going to be tested in the next 2 years to determine its efficiency, safety. And then we have currently 3 licensees. Now I hesitate, I almost said 4, but we have transferred one of those licensees from Coos Bay to the Columbia Willamette River system in recognition of the lessened economy in the Coos Bay area. So now we now have 3 licensees serving the Coos Bay area.
Okay. Representative Patrick?
And they're limited. Who determines how many licenses can be let?
The board does, in the rate setting process.
Okay, and what do these people make? What is a bar pilot in a Columbia? I mean, my understanding is they make
6-figure income.
Like a $200,000 a year income.
Mr. Chair, Representative Patrick, it seems somewhat convoluted, I admit, but their compensation is determined by the difficulty of their job. Comparable salaries for pilots in other maritime states, how much shipping you can expect in this area to support their salaries. So the board designates what is known as a target net income. And in this last rate hearing, that target net income was determined to be $155,000 per year.
Want to give up the law and become a bar pilot?
Sure.
Okay.
Are we just going to determine some fee schedule stuff?
Suzanne will be addressing fees if there's any projected fee increase or not. That'll be something she'll address in her presentation. So.
Okay, I'll wait until the presentation.
Okay. Suzanne?
I wanted to continue on with what the board has been undertaking. The pilot selection process was taken over by the board. It was historically deferred to the pilot association. And in 1995, the board undertook the pilot selection process. And we have interviewed probably close to 50 individuals to select pilots for anticipated vacancies for the Columbia Willamette River and the Columbia River Bar pilotage grounds. So we hope that that mitigates the perception that there is, you know, some sort of buy-in system. You have to buy your way in to get this job. I wasn't aware that that was a perception that was noted by other people.
When I first came here 25 years ago, that's where it was. It's like a fishing license coast to coast. There's limited entry on salmon fishing. The only way to get in is by somebody else's license. We get in, it's called a limited entry system.
Mr. Chair, the board was directed in the 1993 legislative session to undertake the selection process of the pilots and also to implement an apprentice and training program to allow equal access to the occupation. And the board has, I think, very successfully implemented that directive.
Jim, you maybe indicate for the committee some nominations for new pilots that do not have family or personal relationships to board members, because it's quite frankly, you're talking about opening up the system of apprenticeship. It's always been a closed system that you referred to a lady being trained now for the Willamette, but it's kind of the good old boy syndrome there that the pilots board has operated under. Do you have any selection, so that the selection process is indeed independent?
Mr. Chair, let me quickly go through the criteria for the selection process. The board provides applications for individuals who are interested in becoming licensed pilots. Selection is based on a point system, for education, federal licensure, experience, and then at that point, all of these applicants are given an opportunity to interview. They are interviewed by three members of the board, a public member, more recently the last 2 years that public member has been the chair of the board, an industry member, and a pilot member. Those three individuals conduct the interviews. They all individually score the interviews based on criteria, how the applicant handles the interview, the applicant's responses to the questions, and they all assign an individual score from 0 to 25 points for each applicant. I take the three individual scores from each of the interviewers for each applicant, and I average those scores out and apply them to the score that they initially have for their application, their licensure, their education. And then that score determines who will be the next individual to fill an upcoming vacancy.
Okay. Any other questions? Senator Lim.
How long will it take to be a pilot from the beginning? I think we discussed some of the issues of that affirmative action, especially minority, especially women. It takes a long time to be a pilot. So how long will it take to get there?
Mr. Chair, Senator Lim, that's a very difficult question to answer, in that many of the individuals coming in who are applying for these positions have been in the industry for quite some time already, gaining experience on commercial vessels, on commercial tug and tow systems, on the river systems, on passenger vessels. And because the industry is shrinking, many vessels are going foreign flag, there are fewer and fewer jobs on those vessels for these individuals coming out of the Maritime Academy, trying to work their way up the ladder, getting higher and higher licensure. There are a lot of deck officer licenses that are graduated depending on your experience in the system. Many of the individuals who come in to apply have been in the system at least 10 years.
Okay. Representative Patrick.
I'm just wondering what kind of investigation, I mean, part of this, what's supposed to be done is investigations. I'm just wondering, you know, in light of the recent two running aground, both the barge and the, you know, and the new Carissa, I'm wondering what kind of job this board is doing, what kind of oversight they're doing, how many investigations have they done in regards to bar pilots, you know. Can you elaborate on that?
Chair, Representative Hatchett, that's a really very good question, in that in the last year the board has reviewed its incident investigation procedures. Before I get into that, I would like to point out that the incidents that you referred to did not involve a pilot on board the vessel. The board's sole jurisdiction in incident investigations is to determine if the pilot acted prudently and professionally and, you know, was not in error. It was not a pilot's judgment that caused that incident to occur. On average, the board investigates approximately 12 incidents a year involving pilots. Most of them are as a result of a mechanical failure of the vessel or involve some other incident which happened on the bridge that was out of the pilot's control. So the incident with the new Carissa, there was no pilot on board. The incident with the barge that you're referring to, a minor grounding, unfortunately, since new Carissa, such simple things as minor groundings get a lot of media attention, even though they occur quite regularly on the river system. To get back to what the board has been doing, it's improved its investigation procedures to have a policy of, in certain incidents, where there is a significant amount of damage, where there may have been a loss of life, I'm not aware of any incident where that has occurred in my memory, however, or when there's some serious injury, the board would either, A, convene a three-member panel of an industry member, a public member, and a pilot member to investigate the incident, or, given the brothers of the chair, hire an independent investigator to investigate the facts, report the facts to the board for the board to make a determination.
Yes.
My understanding was is that there's, on this new Carissa accident, that there's been some concern about the fact that there was a pilot that they radioed in and asked for a pilot to come out and bring them across the, you know, the bar, and the pilot didn't come out at that point and left them out there, and I'm wondering why that's not being investigated, what's going on with that, why isn't the board looking at those kinds of things. It's of substantial cost to us for Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, all those other issues, and I need a good explanation, I guess, of why, with all the environmental damage and money that has to be expended both by the federal government and the state of Oregon, why those kinds of things aren't being looked into as well. And it concerns me that if you have a pilot and a shipping member and someone else, you don't bring in an independent investigator, and the cost of these environmental cleanups is just huge.
States Coast Guard. It is my understanding. It is my understanding, based upon the review of the facts submitted and the investigation and hearings which were attended by the board that were conducted by the Coast Guard, the pilot involved that was scheduled to bring that vessel in
was contacted by that vessel when it was at least 12 to 15 miles offshore. At that time, the bar crossing was too rough, and the pilot advised the master of that vessel that it was too rough for either the pilot to get across or the vessel to come across. It was unsafe. He also advised them that he would contact them in the morning after he had a chance to observe. They have to visually observe the conditions on the bar to see how rough it's going to be and whether it would be prudent to try and cross or not. By the time the pilot had gone out to the point to check the bar, he saw that the vessel was already well close into the North Spit, and it was just prior to its grounding, and he was shocked. He had no idea that the master of the vessel was going to try and bring the vessel in closer to shore. And by that time, the vessel had already grounded. A pilot was flown out later in the afternoon to try and take the vessel off the beach. That was one of our board members, Captain Stephen Woods. And he was on that vessel for 36 hours and threw a couple of tides trying to remove it. He was almost successful, but the waves were so heavy that they bumped the vessel up over onto another sand dune, basically, and it was lodged.
Suzanne, I'm going to have to stop you right there. The Senate convenes at 10 o'clock. Can we ask you to come back in the morning when you can get here within your time frame, 9:30, 10 o'clock or so, and then try to deal with this tomorrow again. If there's no other discussion, we're going to be adjourned for today. Again, I'm going to emphasize we're going to meet at 8 o'clock tomorrow like we did today and go to 10. Friday morning, we're going to meet after the formal Ways and Means Committee because we could not last very long, and we're trying to spend more time in it. If we can get our committee work back on schedule, then we can go back to a four-day meeting. But right now, it looks like our workload is increasing rather than decreasing. So we are adjourned until 8 o'clock tomorrow morning. Okay.